know what else I learned from Hitchhikers? Time is an illusion, lunchtime doubly so. That's a quote that rings clear bells with physicist Julian Barber, who has long claimed that time is not fundamental, though I'm not sure about his thoughts on lunch. With a bit of help from FQXI, Barber has produced a video about his latest ideas, which you can find on the website www.fqxi.org/community. He's also got a blog post up and is very kindly taking questions about a theory of shape dynamics that he's developing, which could lead us to a theory of quantum gravity, uniting general relativity and quantum mechanics. I spoke to him about his research, beginning with his belief that time does not exist.
The idea about time is that it really cannot be a fundamental part of the universe, that it must somehow either derive from change. Psychologically, we wouldn't be aware of the passage of time if what we perceive doesn't change. I'm looking out of the window now and the leaves on the walnut tree are blowing in the wind. And that tells me things are changing. And Ernst Mach said it's utterly impossible to measure the changes of things by time. Much rather, time is an abstraction at which we arrive from the changes of things. And that has very far-reaching consequences and goes a long way to explain the structure of Einstein's general theory of relativity.
Why is that? Why does having this picture in which time is not fundamental, how does that help us understand general relativity? Because when we think about general relativity, we think about space-time.
Yes, a very important discovery that was made at the end of the 1950s in this country by the great British physicist Paul Dirac, and in the United States by three physicists, Arnavit, Deser, and Misner. And what they did was not to look at general relativity as a theory of space-time given once and for all. This is the famous block universe picture in which time looks as if it's more or less exactly the same as space. Instead, they tried to understand the general relativity as a dynamical theory. The key concept in Einstein's original formulation is the metric of four-dimensional space-time, so that when they started out on this work, particularly Dirac, he expected that as you moved in the time direction through space-time, what you would find would be the complete four-dimensional metric of space-time changing. That what he discovered is that it's not that way at all. What is actually happening is that it's not the four-dimensional metric which is changing. It's three-dimensional geometry at each instant of time. So for Dirac was a very remarkable discovery, and he was so impressed it led him to question whether four-dimensional symmetry is a fundamental feature of the physical world. And he expressed that sentiment in one single sentence, which I read by chance back in the autumn of 1963, and it sparked a whole lot of thinking on my part, particularly what on earth is time, and it completely changed my whole life. There is another aspect of time which I see as what I call time capsules, which is you can also find time sitting within static configurations. This you see in the Earth, where the geologists looked at the structure of rocks and things like that. And they came to the conclusion that you could only explain this static structure of the world by assuming that it was the outcome of an immensely long process that had taken place in time in accordance with laws. So that's evidence for time in static configurations. And any photograph, for example, of a speedboat going through water where it's creating a wave behind it going out to the sides, you just look at that picture and you say instantly, this is a speedboat, you know, traveling pretty fast. And you could even, if you were a physicist, perhaps calculate the speed. And that's all in a static configuration. So those are two ways that time are manifested. And I think that the latter possibility through what I call time capsules is very profoundly related to this issue of why time seems to have a direction, why the past seems so very different from the future.
This time capsule way of thinking about things helps us understand why time appears to have a direction. Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Yes, well, first of all, let me amplify a little bit why I came to the idea of time capsules at all. I mentioned early on this idea of Mach, that time does not come before change, but time is an abstraction from change. Now, this is unquestionably right in the heart of general relativity when it's treated as a dynamical principle. That's in the framework of classical theory. When you come to try and treat general relativity as a quantum mechanical theory, you get the remarkable thing which is called the Wheeler-DeWitt equation, which is what one hopes will describe the quantum mechanics of the universe. One thing it seems to suggest is that time will play no part at all in the quantum mechanics of a closed universe. That caused a great deal of surprise and is known as the problem of time. Time seems to disappear. So what you have in the Wheeler-DeWitt equation, it suggests that the only thing that exists are static, unchanging configurations of the universe, somewhere existing in some platonic realm, eternally unchanging. So where on earth does the notion of time, where does the sensation of time comes from? Then, just over 20 years ago, it occurred to me that configurations can be very special. I mean, you can throw down 100 black dots on a bit of paper in a totally random way, and it means nothing. But a cartoonist can make a very interesting story out of 100 black dots if they're arranged appropriately on the page. And this led me to the idea of time capsules and the realization that we find them all over the universe. They're everywhere. We find these very special structures, which we interpret them at the moment as having arisen dynamically through time and surviving that process of evolution as some record of what has gone before. But it occurred to me that maybe you can eliminate that sort of process happening through time and say, well, they just are created by a timeless quantum mechanics. And then comes a very significant thing, I believe, which, as far as I know, nobody else has really taken seriously, which is that configurations are all different. Every single configuration that the universe can have is different. So you have a space of configurations of the universe, or I prefer to think of it as a space of the possible shapes of the universe. And this shape space, let me call it shape space, it is very asymmetrical. Every shape space, every way that you can think about the possible shapes of the universe and consider all of the possible shapes, there's always one shape which is uniquely distinguished. It's the shape which is more uniform than any other shape. You see this very well if you just had a universe that consisted of three particles in Euclidean space, then in any instant they would form a triangle. That's the shape of the universe in that instant. And there is a uniquely distinguished shape of triangles, and that's the equilateral triangle. And it's there by absolute mathematical necessity. All the other triangles are, in some senses, more complicated than the equilateral triangle. Now, as soon as you start putting in more particles, then you get a very, very rich structure of shape space. And certainly with particles, there's a unique way of characterizing how complicated they are. And this puts a very pervasive structure onto shape space. You go from the most uniform shapes through to shapes of ever-increasing complexity, and the complexity of these shapes can grow without limit. And there's no question that we find time capsules all around us. The most amazing thing about the universe is the extraordinary consistency of the story it tells. We have this idea of a Big Bang, which, by the way, seems to have been very uniform, which I think is very suggestive. And then we find it's been getting ever more complicated structures.
I have a philosophical question about your conception of time. When we try to think about
the fact that people perceive time as flowing, and try and square that with your conception that we have static configurations and time comes out of arranging these configurations. Does that mean in this picture that our minds or our consciousness transcends those configurations and can somehow experience and interpret multiple configurations? Or does that mean that they're almost separate consciousnesses existing within each snapshot, and each of those at some instant can only experience what's happening in that instance, and then are looking at that, the sort of the shapes and the configurations, and inferring what must have happened in the past from within, sort of confined within one configuration?
Now, let me make one observation to start with. What evidence do we have that the past exists, that we started this conversation, for example? Now, I would say that there's really only two bits of information that we have. One is very direct. If I move my hand across my face rapidly, I literally see the movement. I think one is aware of that. One is aware very directly that the movement began, shall we say, on the left of my field of view, and my hand moved across to the right. And so that gives you a very clear idea of a short duration of time. So that's direct evidence. Then the only other evidence we have is all in the form of records. In the first place, it's memories in our head. Now, actually, proving that they can be ordered in a sequence that would correspond to a passage of time is not at all easy. You have to think quite hard to say, now, did I go to Jamaica before I went to somewhere else? You know, I mean, it's often quite difficult to reconstruct your own life from memories. To come back, though, to my example of moving your hand, what we do know is that in your brain at any instant, there's a lot of information which is actually covering a period of perhaps certainly a quarter of a second in the external world. So I think it's definitely true that in your brain there's information simultaneously about all the positions of your hand in that period of motion that I described. So my conjecture is that our seeing motion and experiencing other changes directly, but motion is the most vivid one, is somehow something that consciousness does. I don't question the existence of some counterpart of what I call motion in my brain. And I would say my brain can be likened to one snapshot, but there are snapshots within snapshots. So that one big snapshot contains, among other things, a collection of other snapshots which are of my hand in different positions. And that somehow or other consciousness creates the sensation of motion out of that. Now, there's quite good evidence in support of that. The first thing, for example, is just what are called the secondary qualities, like colors and tastes and smells and sounds. No physicist believes that there really are colors out in the world, only just wavelengths of light. So we're already used to saying that they're not really in the external world. Well, I'm just taking that one further step, admittedly pretty radical, by saying that really motion is not there out there in the external world, but something that we can correlate with the motion that we do observe is out there in the world. This is the fundamental assumption of science, is that to everything we experience, there is something real out there in the external world, and actually establishing what it is, really, a lot of what science is about. That's basically my viewpoint. Now, in my book, The End of Time, I conjectured that everything is all in one single brain configuration, so that my sense of motion comes from consciousness being fed by everything that is in one single brain configuration. It's different in any instant, but it's always just one. Now, more recently, I've been wondering whether there might be alternative ways that somehow or other the brain has access to more than one configuration, or also is attuned to the specifically quantum aspects. In quantum gravity, one postulates the existence of what is called the wave function of the universe. Now, maybe consciousness is not only tied to the actual an instantaneous configuration, but also to the way the wave function of the universe is behaving in the vicinity of this configuration. So, but this is still very tentative on my part. But somehow or other, I think that ultimately, to understand quantum mechanics and to understand the universe, we will have to have a much deeper understanding of what is happening with consciousness. It is the great, huge mystery at the moment. Maybe somebody will have one brilliant idea which will completely transform our thinking. I used to be convinced that consciousness, there would never be a proper theory of consciousness in my lifetime, but that there might be one of quantum gravity. I'm now beginning to think that quantum gravity is such a technically difficult subject that perhaps there might just be a theory of consciousness before quantum gravity.
So this brings us on to your work on shape dynamics. Can you just sort of contrast it with the way that people usually handle Einstein's general relativity? They don't tend to think so much in terms of shape. What do they do?
Either they think in terms of space-time as a complete entity. Then if they're thinking of gravity as being something which is about dynamical evolution, then they think of it not in terms of shape space, but in terms of what is called superspace. Now, the reason for that is because in general relativity, as it's normally formulated, you have relativity of simultaneity. What do you mean by simultaneity is it's a slice through space-time. It's a bit like taking a loaf of bread and cutting it in half with a sharp knife, but not cutting it cleanly at right angles to the line of the loaf, but in some sort of curvy manner so that you get a curved surface. Now, that's what people call a hypersurface within space-time. And in Einstein's general theory of relativity, in its standard formulation, you can cut up space-time. You can imagine the loaf of bread being cut in many different ways, all of them curved and all of them leading to different, what are called space-like hypersurfaces. All of those taken together make up what is called superspace. Now, each of those slices is really a three-dimensional geometry. And so that's the picture that virtually everybody who works in general relativity has. And they are stuck with that because they insist on relativity of simultaneity. When they divide up space-time, they divide it up in this way. And what that means is that they can never really deal with pure shapes. They're always dealing with a mixture of shape and distance. After all, let's go back to a triangle. A triangle has a shape, which is defined by its angles, and those are dimensionless numbers. They don't depend on any particular unit. And then a triangle has a size. And that depends upon you having some external measuring ruler to measure it by. And I find that very, very suspicious if we're thinking about the whole universe. So what shape dynamics does is actually, it's very drastic, but it comes out very nicely out of first principles that only relative quantities should count. What we find is that we do recover Einstein's space-time, but we recover it with an absolutely rigorous rule that you can only cut it, so to speak, at right angles to the long direction of the loaf. So we're always cutting space-time properly so that we could make decent pieces of toast after successive slices. And then what is wonderful is that then just as with a triangle where you can take out the size and just be left with the shape, we can do that exactly in each of these clean slices that we make. So we can then treat general relativity as a theory in which only shapes change. And that's very interesting, and it's really rather wonderful the way it comes out.
Now, you mentioned that you have successfully reproduced general relativity. And obviously, general relativity has been remarkably successful at explaining the motions of planets. So why do we need to look at it in another way, to look at it in terms of shape?
First of all, it gives us something which it's actually already had for 40 years. This is very important work that was done by an American called Jimmy York and his first student, an Irishman called Neil O'Murahu, who has been working with me on and off for the last 13 years. And there's a very important technical issue, which is called the initial value problem. Now, what York found was that the only way he could solve that problem was by precisely doing what we do, which is cut that loaf of space-time exactly at right angles to get a clean slice. Now, he didn't have any a priori reason coming from really deep, sort of, shall we say, philosophical arguments for doing that. He just found that then the mathematics worked. And to this day, nobody has found any other way to actually handle the dynamical equations of motion except by using York's method. And this is absolutely vitally important and is getting ever more important by the day because of the work that's done now in numerical relativity, where they're doing all these calculations which actually tell you what happens when black holes interact and eventually merge to make one bigger black hole. None of that work would be possible without this initial solution of the initial value problem, which York discovered. Now, what shape dynamics does is it doesn't really find a new method, but it gives a very clean first principles derivation of York's method. York found his method by trial and error. I spent 6 weeks with him 20 years ago in North Carolina, and he explained to me very honestly that he just found it by trial and error and a bit of sort of good luck. But once he found it, he found that the mathematics worked so well, he was convinced there must be some good physical reason underlying it. Well, I believe we've actually now found that. So we've done a great deal to strengthen that position of York. It hasn't changed anything in practical terms as yet, but it could do much more significantly in the long run with this huge problem of creating a quantum theory of gravity. Because one of the very greatest problems in attempts that have been made up to now have been, what is the quantum theory of gravity about? And the relativity of simultaneity, which has been regarded as so fundamental in relativity theory, is actually the source of an immense difficulty because it comes back to this issue of how you can slice up space-time. Do you slice it with clean slices at right angles or these incredibly wiggly things which can be cut any way you like? Now, if you cut it any way you like, you just don't know what you're talking about. You don't know what gravity is really about. It's some completely indefinable mixture of quantities to do with size and quantities to do with shape. And there's no way that you can disentangle anything out of this mishmash. I mean, as a four-dimensional space-time theory at the level of classical physics, Einstein's original formulation is incredibly beautiful and economic. When you try and quantize it, it becomes an absolute nightmare. There are problems to do with divergences. It doesn't seem to make mathematical sense in that sense. But there's also this huge conceptual problem of what on earth is it about? Now, the potentially great advantage of shape dynamics is that it says absolutely unambiguously what gravity is about. It's about the change of shapes, or it's about probabilities for shapes of the universe. And that's a very clean statement. It's also very good in that it doesn't involve any dimensionful quantities. Any dimensionful quantity is suspect. It doesn't really tell you anything about the world to say that your foot is a foot long, because we know back in the Middle Ages that was just the length of the new king's foot when he came in, inherited the throne. You're not saying anything about the world. You're saying something about the relationship of an object to a humanly chosen unit. And somehow or other, that is still hopelessly mixed in with general relativity when you treat it in the way that it has been done up to now. So shape dynamic has great scope, I believe, in the long run to resolve that issue.
Now, I understand that some of your collaborators have been looking at quantum gravity, I guess in some detail. Are you encouraged by their results so far?
I would say that they've made the case for shape dynamics more plausible, and they've been exploring interesting avenues. One of the, I think the most promising one is the work being done by, above all, by Tim Koslovsky and Enrique Gomez, who've published several papers together. And they initially published another paper with Sean Gribb, where they put shape dynamics in a particularly convenient form for the study of quantum phenomena. It's a sort of cleanly formulated gauge theory, and gauge theory has always been very, very helpful and useful in making progress in physics. That's the standard model is all about gauge theory. So they're making a connection with methods which have proved to be very powerful. And what is really interesting about shape dynamics is the take it has on symmetry. Now, symmetry underlies gauge theory, and it's an extremely important tool in modern theoretical physics. And what is really interesting about general relativity is that there are two symmetry principles which are coexisting within the one theory. There's the original space-time symmetry, which is reflected in the relativity of simultaneity that Einstein originally found. So that was absolutely crucial to the way Einstein found general relativity. But building on this early work of Jimmy York, what shape dynamics has shown is that there's a second symmetry that is existing at the same time as relativity of simultaneity, which is completely different. It's relativity of size, or local size. It's a very powerful symmetry, which on the face of it looks quite different, and in fact completely inconsistent with relativity of simultaneity, because it's saying you're not allowed to slice the loaf in an arbitrary way. You must slice it at right angles to the loaf. So on the face of it, general relativity sitting within it are what seem to be two mutually incompatible symmetry principles. It's very surprising that somehow or other they're not incompatible. Now, the idea that Tim Koslovsky and Enrique Gomez are exploring is what they call doubly general relativity. They're saying that within the general framework of gauge theory, it may be possible, it's still a may because they haven't yet really brought this to any conclusion yet, it may be possible to take advantage of both symmetries at once. Any symmetry is helpful, so if you've got two, maybe that'll be doubly helpful. So that's the inspiration. Now, this is an idea which I personally could never have developed. I'm not nearly into gauge theory in the way that Tim and Enrique are. It seems to me this is a very interesting possibility. We shall just have to wait and see whether it really comes to fruition. But I don't think this is going to happen quickly, because quantum gravity is an immensely difficult task. There still remain huge mathematical complexities that have to be overcome before we have a theory of quantum gravity. So I'm not expecting any results soon, but at least we have a clear direction in which to go, which I would say has not hitherto existed. And there's lots of other observations which my collaborators are making. They are related to this issue that I was already addressing, is what is gravity about? What is going on in gravity? Is it about relativity of simultaneity, or is it about changes of shape? And clarifying the ontology, what is very important. So my biggest hope for shape dynamics is that it is actually telling us what the universe is made of. What is the universe in its innermost core? It's about shapes, I think, and not about sizes.
That was Julian Barber explaining why shape is more real than time. You'll also find links to videos featuring Julian's work, his book, and his FQXI blog, where he welcomes questions about shape dynamics and the illusion of time on the site www.fqxi.org/community/podcast.